Okay, so it's April 10th, 2010. We're in London. We're here for Michelle's birthday party. This is not a birthday party. This is all a figment of our imagination. Okay, folks, we're now Buddhists. None of this exists. Right. Well, I thought the most appropriate thing to talk about on a birthday party is parties. What do you think? Huh? All right. So I thought we'd read from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 19, Text 31. Does anybody have any idea what that chapter is about? Canto 3, Chapter 19. Any good guesses? Not yet. Well, it's really the end of... I mean, Kardama Muni is like kind of out of the picture at this point. Yeah. Any other guesses? Pachinibharisha? No, that's Canto 4. That's way ahead. Come on, who's before Lord Kapiladev? Anybody ever read through the Bhagavatam starting at the beginning? Yeah, okay, well, what story are they talking about? What's the story? First time I read this story, I was so... No cheating! You can tell how he passed his exams in school. How many years? Well, if you listen carefully to the Sanskrit, you'll understand immediately. This is text 31, so it's close to the last text of the chapter. Maitreya uvacha evam hiranyakasham asya vikrama sasadya vitya hari adi shukara jagamalokam swa akandidotsavam samiditam pushkara vitaradibi. Thank you. Very good. You heard Hiranyaksha and you heard adi sukara. Adi Sukaraha means the first four. Maitreya Uvacha means?
Maitreya.
There you go, that's easy. Evam?
Thus.
Hiranyaksham. So easy. Asaya Vikrama. What's Vikrama mean? Steps, or actually means powerful steps. Very powerful. Saha, the Lord. Means he, literally. Sada yitva, after killing. Harihi means?
The Lord.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead. Adi sukaraha means? Oh, you ladies are all sleeping. I already told you what it means. The first bore. Jagama, returned. Lokam, planet, his abode. Swam, his own abode. So, swam, lokam swam, his own abode. Now, here's what we're going to focus on. Akandita means uninterrupted. It never stops. What is it that never stops? Utsavam. What's an utsava?
Festival.
A festival. So, akandita utsavam means?
Never-ending
festival. And of course, the a and the u become o, so it becomes akanditotsavam. Akanditotsavam. Samaditaha, being praised. Pushkar Vistara, lotus seat, which means by Lord Brahma, who sits on a lotus. Adibihi, and all the others. Translation. Sri Maitreya continued. After thus killing the most formidable demon, Hiranyaksha. What does Hiranyaksha literally mean? Golden what?
Eyes.
Yeah, golden eyes. Like lions have gold, have yellow eyes. So Hiranyaksha had yellow eyes. After thus killing the most formidable demon, Hiranyaksha, the Supreme Lord Hari, the origin of the boar species, How many religions in the world talk about God as being the original born? Only one. Return to his own abode, where there was always an
party.
That wasn't quite the way Robert translated it. Yes. Where there was always an uninterrupted festival. The Lord was praised by all the demigods headed by Brahma. So I'm just going to read one paragraph from the purport. Although the Lord has his particular abode in which to reside, he is all-pervasive. The impersonalists accept one aspect of the Lord's features, the all-pervasive aspect, but they cannot understand his localized situation in his transcendental abode, where he always engages in fully transcendental pastimes. Especially mentioned in this verse is the word, what word again? What's the word? Good, 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 close. Akandit-otsavam. Akandita-utsava, it becomes akandit-otsavam. Now here Prabhupada says, utsava means pleasure. Whenever some function takes place to express happiness, it is called utsava. So what are utsavas for? Expressing happiness. Utsava, the expression of complete happiness, is always present in the Vaikuntha Lokas, the abode of the Lord, who is worshipable even by demigods like Brahma, to say nothing of other less important entities, such as human beings. Of course, we tend to think that we're the most important. So, people want to be happy and express happiness. People look for vacations, for parties, for some sort of celebration. Even people who don't like parties, there actually are people who don't like parties. Like,
oh, I gotta socialize with people.
I know people like that.
Let me just stay in my room.
Even they like to celebrate. Maybe they have different ways of celebrate. But everybody likes to celebrate. Celebrate is to express happiness. And so in Vaikuntha Loka, they're always celebrating. They're always expressing happiness, which must mean that they always have happiness to express. You know, in this world, it's kind of hard always to have a party for several reasons. First of all, you'd have a hard time paying the mortgage if you always had a party. And second of all, we don't always have some happiness to express. The vast majority of the time, we feel like there's nothing to celebrate at all. You know, what's the occasion for a party? So I was thinking that we could look at different kinds of happiness and different ways of expressing it. Does that sound all right? Is that okay with everybody? So we know that Bhagavad Gita talks about happiness in the and passion and ignorance, and then also transcendental happiness. So which should we look at first? Should we start from the bottom or start from the top? Let's start from the bottom and go up. Okay. Sorry, kid. I did not ask her to leave. I figure that's going to be me in a few years, you know. Hopefully you'll all be nice to me when I'm running around, little kid. All right, so happiness in the mode of ignorance is just misery from beginning to end. It's not actually happiness at all. Happiness in the mode of ignorance comes from, well, it's the kind of happiness we feel. I mean, maybe none of you ever feel this way, but I've experienced this. The happiness we feel when we do something wrong and we've gotten away with it. Nobody caught. And it's sort of the happiness a little kid feels when they turn over the rubbish bin. It doesn't have any particular purpose. It's not like they're going to take out the rubbish and play with it instead of their toys. But they delight in it, don't they? You see, little kids, 1, 2 year old. So what's the happiness? It's an interesting kind of happiness. So the happiness from doing something wrong. We know it's wrong. The thing itself doesn't give us any pleasure. Have you noticed that about grossly sinful things? They don't really give much pleasure in and of themselves. The main pleasure is, I'm doing something wrong and I'm getting away with it. Another kind of happiness in the mode of ignorance is when we've got something at the expense of somebody else. I beat out that guy for the job. You know, so especially someone who's been bothering you or who's in your way, you've gotten them out of your way, you got them in trouble, you know, you superseded them in your exams or in your how much money you have or which girl you got or something. You got better than somebody else. You got something at someone else's expense. Happiness in the mode of ignorance is also happiness that comes from having power over others. I can control you. A lot of lust in this world is also like that. I can control you. I can manipulate you. I can get you to do what I want. I somehow or other have power over you. And a lot of what drives the activities in the world is this very much mode of ignorance. I can control you in a nasty way. I can control you through fear. I can control you through threats. I can control you because I have more money than you. I can control you because I'm beautiful. I can control you because I'm intelligent. And I'm going to get you to do what I want, even if it's not favorable for you. I met one gentleman who brags about how he makes a lot of money in third world countries by exploiting people. He takes pleasure in that. You know, I'm paying people below market wages, and I'm making a low quality product, but selling it at a high price. And that way I'm making a lot of money. So that's very much happiness in the mode of ignorance. Of course, then there's very gross aspects of that. I mean, if you go to the lowest level, that would be like the happiness someone gets from murder and robbery and things like that, from intoxication. So those things don't really have any happiness in them at all. If you compare that kind of happiness to joy, the joy you feel, you know, when it's sunny and you're outside in the forest, having a picnic with your friends. You know, if you compare that kind of happiness to the happiness that you get when you have power and control other people through fear and manipulation, or the happiness you get from doing something wrong, you'll find that mode of ignorance happiness has no real happiness. There's no feeling of joy in the heart. Another kind of mode of ignorance happiness is the energy a person gets from anger. When we get angry, we get like a rush of energy, isn't it? Right? So that's also happiness in the mode of ignorance. But there's no joy in any of that. In fact, it's like a constriction, isn't it? It's kind of like your heart closes in on itself. And even while you're enjoying that happiness, you feel yucky. You just feel like, ugh. Yes, I've got power. It's kind of this. So it's never really happiness. It's not really happiness at all. There's something there. Because Krishna says he's also death. He says among cheating, I am gambling. So Krishna's everything. He's also cheating. He's also death. But you're enjoying in the mode of ignorance is not real happiness. So mode of passion happiness is a little different. Mode of passion happiness is righteous. Someone in the mode of passion is very interested in religion. Dharma. Doing what's right, doing what's honorable, and being honored for it. Doing what's honorable and making sure everybody notices I've done something honorable. Giving charity, making sure, see how much charity I've given? See what project I've done? See what temple I've built? See how many books I've distributed? One wants to do something good and honorable, but the focus is on getting honor and getting respect, having some position in the world, having wealth in the world, having status. So there's a little bit of happiness there in the beginning. Actually, in one sense, there's not any real happiness there either. It's really a mental concoction of happiness. It's kind of, I think of it like you have a photograph of your beautiful house and your nice car and your nice family, and you kind of look at it and say, there, I must be happy. It's not really an expansive joy kind of thing, but there are certain sorts of happiness in the mode of passion that are particularly intoxicating, especially illicit sex life. You know, and in the beginning, a person said, yes, I'm in love. And they became so overwhelmed with that, they forget everything in life. Mode of passion happiness tends to be very consuming. But again, it's not anything like real joy, and it very quickly degrades into misery. You know, all the things that you got the honor for and all the opulence that you get, you have to maintain them. It's based on having things. Having things earned righteously and honestly and religiously. But it's based on, you know, having the degrees, having the house, having the car, having the attractive family where all your kids went to the best schools. Having a good record of being an upright citizen. Having material accomplishments. And all of those things are very fleeting. Yukaliyam ashasvatam. Ashasvatam. It has no permanence. You have a nice house, but how long will this house last? Old buildings are maybe 200 years old. That's not a long time, 200 years. Remember when we built a school building, I said, how long will this last? They said, oh, maybe 60 years. That's all. I mean, doing all this work for 60 years. And the accomplishments become forgotten. They don't stay. How many businesses stay hundreds and hundreds of years? Few. I'm sure there's some here in London that, you know, can stay established 1816 or something. But. And the honor is also forgotten. And all of those sort of opulences are also very shaky. We talk about how Lakshmi is chanchala. Lakshmi, Shri, all the opulences. Think about all the opulences. I mean, wealth is very shaky, isn't it? Especially modern wealth. It's just numbers in a computer. And then like that, your numbers can buy you only half the things they bought you yesterday. Correct? It happens overnight. It happened to my daughter-in-law's father. He said he lost half of his wealth overnight. Or even your property. You know, property can decrease in value. The government can take your property. There can be a war and you can lose your property. There can be a fire. I mean, all of our wealth is subject to be lost. What are the other opulences? Beauty. So beauty doesn't last. Those of you who are young and beautiful, some of you here are young and beautiful. You don't see anybody who's 80 who's beautiful. It doesn't last. Or just a bad accident or a disease, it's gone. It can be gone in a moment. It can be so beautiful, you get in a car accident, the beauty is gone. Chanchala. And then knowledge. So knowledge again, I mean, you just get in a head-on collision, you may not remember anything. I remember your name. But to speak of a death, that's one of the reasons we're really scared of death, you know that. Death means that we lose this whole identity we've built up. We've spent so long building it up. This is my parents, this is my home, this is when I was born, this is what I've done. And it can be lost. Not can be, will be. Right, what's another opulence? Strength. So again, generally, old people are not so strong. And some small disease, accident can be gone. What others are there? You missed any? Fame. Oh, my goodness. Especially in the modern age, you can lose, your fame can turn to infamy in an instant on the internet. You know? Just say one stupid thing into a microphone. It's finished. Get out of your position. Isn't it? Doesn't that happen? Mm-hmm. Some big politician or somebody, and they just say one really stupid thing. They just weren't thinking. You know? Maybe they meant some. No, that wasn't what I meant. I meant. Get out. Too late. It's already in the microphones. Especially they say that they don't think the microphones are on anymore. Right? They think the microphones are turned off, and then they say, there's something, you know. It goes all over the world. I forget what election year there was. In America, there was one politician running, and after some victory, he made some big roaring noise into the microphone. And just from doing that, he was out of the running. So that's also very shaky. So the motive passion is based on these opulences. Fame, wealth, knowledge, strength, beauty. And so this happiness is full of anxiety. If one is celebrating because one has achieved beauty or knowledge or wealth or fame, strength, you're celebrating something that you can lose like that. and therefore it's mixed with anxiety. It's mixed with fear, and from fear comes anger. And we find that happiness in the mode of passion. Krishna explains, of course, this sequence in 262 Bhagavad Gita. It leads to great attachment. He talks twice in the Bhagavad Gita about attachment, fear, and anger. So this happiness is, I have this. Now I got to hold it. Now I got to protect it. I'm sure nobody takes it. But you can't protect it. I'm protecting it. Protect it against time. So you spend your life trying to control everything. And eventually it all turns to misery. You lose it, or you find out that the opulence isn't even so enjoyable. The more you have of the opulence, the more people envy you, try to take it away from you, the more you have to put your energy into protecting it. So it leads eventually to misery. So happiness in the mode of goodness is quite different. Happiness in the mode of goodness, we start to touch something that's actually happiness. We start to touch something that's actually joy. Krishna says, happiness in the mode of goodness means all the gates of the body are illumined by knowledge. So that means whatever you see as it is. That'd be nice, isn't it? So I've given this analogy before. If you want to go somewhere, if you want to go from here to the Soho Street Temple, you have to have a proper map, right? Or you have to have one of those good tom-toms. You have to know where you're going. You have to have a map that is in accord with the streets. So when you're in the mode of goodness, your map is in accord with reality. In the mode of passion, in the mode of ignorance, you want happiness, but you have the wrong map. You don't get there. You put all your effort into getting happiness, and when you arrive at your destination, there's no happiness there. Somebody gave you the wrong directions. And modern society is full of giving directions in the mode of passion and ignorance. If you really want to be happy, don't listen to those religious people. They're just trying to restrict you. Just do whatever you feel like. Get a good degree, make a lot of money, get a big house, get status in society, then you'll be happy. But that's not the right map. What's really funny is that even the atheistic, materialistic scientists know that it's the wrong map. They'll tell you. Research shows that once you have the bare necessities of life, more money doesn't make you happy. Just materially speaking, that's what really makes you happy, your good relationships. Are there any courses like that in school? Having good relationships. So they know it's the wrong map, and still they're teaching that map. So in the mode of goodness, everything is illumined by knowledge. You understand how to actually get happiness. You hear things as they are. You see things as they are. You taste things as they are. Your senses are not distorted. The world appears to you to be happily situated. Actually, someone in the mode of goodness, they're experiencing happiness all the time. Now, this is another interesting feature. If we compare passion, goodness, and ignorance. So in the mode of ignorance, you're never really happy. You have some sort of a energy from anger or from envy or from greed. But it's not happiness. It's never really happiness. It's energy, but it's not happiness. Just like both pain and pleasure are electrical impulses in the brain. So there's some charge, but it's not happiness. In the mode of passion, you have happiness occasionally on a superficial level. It's based on something fruitive. So if we think of fruitive, a fruit. So if my happiness is based on a fruit, so to get the fruit, I have to plant the seed, I've got to water the seed, I've got to pull the weeds, I've got to keep the goats and elephants away. Right? Then I've got to wait till the seed ripens. Then I pick the seed. Then I eat the seed. I eat the fruit. And how many times a year do I get to eat the fruit? One time a year from my tree. So if one time a year when I get to eat the fruit, the rest of the time I'm taking care of the tree. And it might be that I take care of the tree and there's bugs or disease and I don't get any fruit that year. It happens. So fruitive enjoyment is like that. It's sort of like a carrot that's in front of you. You know? Your happiness in the mode of passion is, okay, when I get there, then I will be happy. Okay, get there, get there, get there, get there, get there. So all the time you're getting there, getting there, getting there, getting there, getting there. You're not happy. Okay, yeah, I know I'm working really hard and doing this. It's really hard. But when I get there, then I will be happy. And every once in a while, you get there. And sometimes there's a fruit, and sometimes there's not. Sometimes when you bite in the fruit, it tastes sweet. Sometimes you bite in the fruit, like, oh my God, there's bugs in there. Okay, next goal. And even if it's really a fruit, how long do you get to enjoy it? Not very long. Then you go for another one. So you have very periodic, your happiness is very rare. It just happens at it's rare intervals, and it's not, you can't count on it. Whereas mode of goodness is there all the time. It's always there because it's not dependent on a fruit. What opulence is a person in the mode of goodness interested in? There was renunciation. There was one we didn't mention in the mode of passion. None of you said it. Renunciation. Renunciation is a very interesting opulence because it's not chanchala like the others. And it's under your control. Is your beauty under your control? Is your beauty under your control? No. Is your wealth under your control? No. Your strength is under your control. Your intelligence, your knowledge is under your control. Your fame is under your control? That's really not under your control. But your renunciation is under your control. It's a really interesting opulence. You can control how renounced you are, and nobody can take it away. It's yours. So if your happiness is in renunciation, in detachment, renunciation doesn't mean that you don't have any possessions. Akinchana doesn't mean, it could mean, but doesn't necessarily mean that all your possessions can fit into a little envelope or that you don't have any possessions. You know, there are people who think like that. They walk around naked. Right? Especially in India, you see that. People who think akinchana must mean that I have nothing. Of course, sometimes they have something. They might have a trident or something that they're carrying around with them. But it means I don't feel I own anything. And my mood is that whatever happens is for the good. Of course, just material goodness, a person does have some attachment to being in truth. An attachment to being in truth. There's usually some mix of passion, some pride there. But there's a feeling of great joy, expansive joy, and freedom. Happiness in the mode of ignorance and the mode of passion is very binding. Happiness in the mode of goodness is conducive to liberation. Then there's, of course, transcendental happiness. Transcendental. It, trans means above, over, right? Like transatlantic, going over the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm a teacher. It's transcending the senses. So in the mode of goodness, the senses are illumined by knowledge, but transcendental happiness goes beyond the senses, or we can say it deals with purified senses. Atta Sri Krishna Namari Na Bhaved Graham Indriya. You cannot understand Krishna with one's material senses. The instruments are too blunt. They're not fine enough to access Krishna. So transcendental happiness is something that's beyond the senses, the gross senses, and beyond even the mind. So in the mode of goodness, the mind is illumined by knowledge, but transcendental is beyond the mind. The goal of yoga is to stop the mind. You know that? It's the goal of yoga, to make the mind just quiet. Leave me alone. Our entanglement in this world is because of the mind. Because we want to be in this world, therefore we have this mind that protects our false ego and says, yes, you're very nice, or no, you're terrible. All it goes back and forth. You're wonderful. No, you're terrible. You're wonderful. You're terrible. You're wonderful. You're terrible. You. The whole universe revolves around you, how wonderful or how terrible you are. You are the most important. Take care of you. That's the business of the mind. So yoga means we just say, shh, go away. It's not about me. So happiness that's transcendental is when we're not taking happiness either in evil or in righteousness or even in truth, but in love. That is transcendental happiness. Even people in the mode of ignorance and passion can get a little idea of that. People in the mode of ignorance may love their cat. It's very difficult to live without any affection. Then you're like a psychopath. Mm-hmm. You have no affection. Even animals have some affection for their young or for their mate. Right? That feeling of affection, Prabhupada says that Krishna has manifested us to enjoy our affection. That's transcendental happiness. Now, the mode of goodness happiness, one achieves it at every moment because it's not dependent on the fruits. I'm illumined now, therefore I'm in joy now. And I'm illumined the next now, and therefore I'm experiencing joy in that now. And I'm always experiencing joy in the now because I'm full of detachment, and therefore I'm not dependent on this carrot over there. But transcendental happiness is unlimited. Anandam buddhivardhanam. Mode of goodness happiness is limited. Transcendental is unlimited. Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, in commenting on the Shikshastakam Anandam Buddhivardhanam, this ocean, it increases the ocean of transcendental bliss. He says, although the jiva is very small, we are all very small, our capacity for joy is unlimited. Unlimited and always increasing. And that happiness has nothing to do with focus on, I forget me. I mean, again, even materialistic people, when they feel some affection for someone, they forget themselves. Like we're celebrating a birthday. Right? So when your baby was born, I bet you forgot about yourself, didn't you? You just thought, oh, my baby. You forgot all about yourself. You forgot where you were, what your name was. You just, where am I? Oh, my baby, look at it. Oh, it's a boy. Is he okay? How many fingers does he have? Right? All of your thought, right? Isn't it? All of your thought is just in the other person. And you put him down to sleep, and you're trying to sleep, and you keep waking up. Is he breathing? If we have a proper person to take care of him, all you're thinking about is him. Of course, that doesn't last in this world. You're probably not still doing that. No. That kind of intense love and affection doesn't last. You know, after you have enough grandchildren and great-grandchildren, you can't even remember all the birthdays anymore. It's funny, my mother told me that happened to her, and I thought, how is that possible? But it happened to me the other day. I was talking to my son, and I said, oh, Devesh had a birthday a week ago, didn't he? I'm like, you forget. Doesn't stay. But we have some idea. We have some idea how when we become absorbed in affection for someone else, we forget ourselves. We're just thinking about the other. Right? Young boy, young girl who are in love, they're just thinking about the other. Not forever, but for a while. Doesn't last. You lose consciousness. You don't care about yourself anymore. You're willing to sacrifice or the person that you love. Or sometimes people sacrifice for the country that they love, or the cause that they love, and they lose themselves in that sacrifice. They forget about themselves. Okay? So that's a little hint what transcendental happiness is like. We lose ourselves in love of God. Not lose ourselves literally in that we lose our identity. We're just so focused on Krishna, 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 Krishna. Is he happy? Does he have something to eat? Does he have nice clothes on? What is he doing today? What did he do yesterday? What demons did he kill? What dances is he performing? What did he say? And that joy keeps expanding and expanding and expanding. So people who have mode of ignorance happiness, it's interesting if we think about how people celebrate happiness, because Prabhupada says here, utsaha means to express happiness. And we find the ways of expressing happiness are basically the same for everybody, aren't they? Get together with some friends. You have food. You have music. Right? Pretty much the same. I mean, the difference is what kind of friends you have, what kind of food you eat, what kind of music you listen to. But it's essentially the same. Friends, food, music, sometimes dancing. If we really want to celebrate, we do something with fire. And you've got a few candles going over there. At our big festival in Russia. Anybody here been to our festival in Russia? So they have these devotees who do fireworks dancing. Fireworks, real fireworks. Of course, it has to be done at night. They have costumes that have lights on them, kind of like Christmas lights on the costumes. And then they have helmets that have fireworks that come out of the helmets. And they have, seriously, their shoulder blades where fireworks come out of their shoulders. And then they have batons where the fireworks come out of the ends and they're twirling the batons. So if you really want to have an extra celebration, then it's usually something with lights or fire. Don't try it in your living room. What else do we do if there's extra celebration? Maybe a lot of flowers, something with color, light, scents. Or we go to a beautiful place,
like a lake.
Do you notice that water is very associated with enjoyment? When people want to go on a vacation, they usually go someplace with water or snow. Sometimes snow. Usually water. You ever thought about how many times a day Krishna goes into the water? It takes at least 4 baths a day. Right? He's swimming in Radhakund in the middle of the day. He swims in the Jamuna at night. Gets a bath in the morning, a bath in the afternoon. And then many times he swims in other places also. He likes to be around water. So if you really, really want to celebrate, then you go out of the house. You go to a park. If you really, really want to celebrate, then you go to like Tahiti. Hawaii or someplace like that. Of course, then you have to have rich friends. We have to have a charter jet and bring everybody there, but you mean go to the ocean. But basically, we see these ways of celebrating are the same. It's just the nature, again, what food you're eating, what music you're listening to, what kind of dancing you're doing, what kind of people you're associating with. But that may change. So, of course, this comes originally because in Goloka Vrindavan, in Vaikuntha, they're always celebrating because they always have something to celebrate. In the mode of ignorance, there's not much to celebrate. You know, I hurt this person, I stole this thing. I won this case in court. In the mode of passion, it's some occasional thing. In the mode of goodness, it's there all the time. And in the transcendence, it's there all the time and ever expanding. Oh, thank you. I need that. Now I got one coming from each end. Sorry, I got one. It's okay. You keep that for yourself when you're going to talk. Oh, okay, good. Thank you. So we're very interested in celebrating. Actually, Prabhupada also said we could have a festival every day. Sorry, managers. Prabhupada also gave instructions about having special festivals every Sunday. I remember the first time I ever visited a temple on Sunday, they were doing a Julian Nectar. They were swinging the deities, although it wasn't that time of the year. And Prabhupada talked about, you know, having different festivals every Sunday for different events. We read about, in Krishna book, we read about the residents of Vrindavan having so many different festivals. So we don't mind finding any excuse for festivals. actually, for us in Krishna consciousness, the way our life should be, is that every moment, like in Vaikuntha, should feel to us like a vessel. We should always be full of joy, and we should always be expressing that joy. Even if we're just alone in our room, we should feel that we're having a festival of ever-expanding bliss. And if we're not, then we're still covered by the modes. But that's the truth. The truth is that we are always full of ever-expanding bliss. We do always have something to celebrate. And we can celebrate all the time. After all, Krishna's in our heart, and if Krishna's there, that means Radharani's there, Mother Yasoda's there, Govardhan Hill's there, the Jamuna's there. Nothing to take a ticket on. So that should be our life. Our life should feel like an unending celebration. You may say, wait a minute, it's hard work being a devotee. A lot of things we do aren't fun. Actually, Bhaktivinoda Thakura said, the trouble we take for Krishna is his great happiness. When we take trouble for Krishna, if we see that this is a way of expressing my love, because transcendental happiness is just love. That's all it is. And one way to express love is sometimes through sacrifice, through inconvenience. Isn't that a way to express love? Therefore, that should also be a cause for celebration. So if you live like this, then you're not dependent on the external results of your activities over which you have no control or very little control. Can we control the external results of our activities? A little bit. We can influence them, but we certainly can't control them. You no longer have happiness dependent on things you can't control. Isn't that nice? Wouldn't that be nice if your happiness is dependent only on things you can control? Then it doesn't matter how somebody else talks to you, how other people treat you, what your health is like, how much money you have, how nice your house is, what the weather is like. Wouldn't that be nice? So that's just a choice. That's a choice. Say, I choose to find my happiness in things I can control. I choose to find my happiness in reality. That's a choice we can make moment by moment. And what can I control? I can control whether or not I feel affection for Krishna. I can control whether or not I see Krishna in this moment of my life. I can control whether or not I'm offering everything to Krishna with affection. And then celebrating that. That to whatever extent I can do that, I'm very small, I can't do it completely. But to whatever extent I can do that, I celebrate that, moment by moment. And then I'm happy. No matter what, whether the festival goes as planned, you know, whether the temple gets built, whether I distribute one book or 100 books, whether I get this, whether I get that, whether I do well on my exams, whether I marry the person I want when I want, or I never marry, where I live, doesn't matter anymore. Doesn't matter anymore. That's not where the source of my happiness is. I may do those things out of duty as my service to Krishna, but that's not where the source of my happiness is. The source of my happiness is my relationship with Krishna. So that's the way our lives should be. That is the essence of spiritual life. And then, of course, we can get together from time to time and have big external celebrations where we take the joy that's in our heart and share it externally. So birthdays of devotees are a nice thing to celebrate. And I was thinking, why? Why do we celebrate birthdays? That's interesting. Why do we celebrate birth and mourn death? I mean, it's such a miserable world. You'd think we would do the opposite. Some people do, probably, yeah. But why do we celebrate birth? I mean, for a soul to come into the human body is a very wonderful thing. And especially to come into a human body with an opportunity for spiritual life is a very wonderful thing. And of course, birth itself, although it's listed as one of the miseries of life, because I've been at many, many births. I've been probably 50 or 60 births. It's really incredible. I I read once where a man said that after the birth of his first child, he immediately became a theist. It must be a god. Because, you know, the mother doesn't know how the baby's forming in her body. She's not consciously engineering it. How does Krishna make these bodies that they create another body? It's pretty amazing. It's not like, you know, a little computer pops out of your computer or something. It's incredible. It's really amazing. How, you know, you're just eating and it forms this whole other body. That's how it is. It is a wonderful miracle. And we also celebrate years spent in devotional service. You know, this human body, it's temporary like others. It's only here for a lightning flash. Nothing we do will be remembered in 100 years. But still, any moment spent. I just, the other day, met a fascinating devotee who's both an initiated Brahmin and an ordained rabbi. It's only the third devotee I've met like that. And I know one devotee who's a Christian minister and also initiated devotee, and another one who's a Catholic monk and initiated devotee. So it's only the third person I met in that kind of category. Fascinating person. Anyway, he was telling me, he said, according to the Jewish sages, if you can even move a hair's breadth toward God, that's glorious. Because in this world is so hard. Right? You can just make a hair's breadth of progress in this life. So what's to speak of somebody who's dedicating their life? So that's also we celebrate. So many years of dedicating your life to Krishna. So thank you very much. Should I ask? Your kirtan was much better than my talk. We should have just had kirtan. It's late, so I probably shouldn't ask for questions. Take maybe 5-10 minutes for questions. I just don't want anybody hating me for going so long. Yes?
Thank you, Madhuma. One thing I remember about, I read about the Govardhan, you know, when they first circumnavigated to Govardhan with Krishna, and it mentions that the inhabitants, they dressed very nicely, you know, looking at us.
Is that a criticism of me?
No.
Well, I was seeing all the ladies dressing up, you know, and I was like...
I remember one time I had some discussion about, you know, why is it that, you know, like, at someone's party, then all the guests will dress luxuriously. You know, because a devotee might think, well, you know, what's that got to do with giving pleasure to Krishna? I dress in, like, some very fine clothes.
It shows that you think it's a special occasion. Something special. You don't wear your normal clothes. Wear some special clothes. You don't have... Everything's different. You have special clothes, there's special food, there's something out of the ordinary. It's a way of showing respect. And you find that just like people have special clothes they'll wear if they go to church once a week, for example. Whether Sunday best, going to God's house. That's fun, too. A lot of people like to dress up. I mean, maybe you're not in that category, but... definitely most women like to dress up. Not all. Not all, but most. And even a lot of guys like to dress up. It's fun. Krishna likes to dress up. That's one of his qualities listed by Rupa Goswami. He likes to dress up. He does all the time. He always looks like he's a dancing actor going on the theatrical stage. I mean, he really goes all out. I told you that he goes swimming or takes a bath several times a day. Well, every time he does that, he gets dressed again. And more often than that, even. Because after he eats, it's like, oh, okay, there's some food on my clothes. He is a very immaculate dresser, and before he's going to fight with the demon, he always, you know,
Just make sure it's all of this.
Right. He always wants to look picture perfect, just in case anybody paints a portrait. So we also have that propensity. We also have that propensity. It's part of the fact that there's a akandidotsavam. The fact that there's a akandidotsavam, that there's always a festival, that Krishna's always dressing up.
Is it also that you know, Krishna's devotees, you know, they like to dress up and Krishna likes to see them enjoying themselves?
Of course. Krishna is not the enjoyer and the controller like some dictator. Bhaktiram Jagasapasam Sarvaloka Maheshwaram. I'm the only enjoyer. Everything is only for me. I'm the controller. No, Suryadam Sarvabhu. It's also the best friend. So, just like the Vedic standard of birthdays. You know, Western birthdays is everything's for me. The Prabhupada writes in Bhagavatam. The standard, you didn't hear that, right? The standard for birthdays is you're supposed to do charity, austerity, and penance. But what Krishna does is he likes to take the food off his plate and give it to his devotees, you know. He sees, okay, this is this thing that Mother Yasoda gave me. That's your favorite food. And he gives it to you. He wants to see you enjoying. Krishna's pleasure is to see us happy. Our pleasure is to see Krishna's happy.
There's also another reason could be that the devotees are thinking, you know, I like to dress up. Krishna likes to see me happy. So, or at least, you know, devotees in Braj, maybe I think, like, you know, Krishna likes to see us happy, dressing up. And so.
Of course. Of course, if you have a party and everybody just comes dressed in their gardening clothes. You know?
What Prabhupada is saying, there's a nice verse in the Chaitanya Charitamrita where the gopis think, if I dress up nicely, Krishna enjoys that.
Yes.
And when they see Krishna being happy, they feel even more happiness than
yes.
Krishna.
Yes. Yes. Krishna has no envy. You know, we don't want anyone to be quite as happy or opulent as we are. Almost. Maybe you can be as happy and opulent as I am in this area, but not in that one. You know? But Krishna, he wants his devotees to be happier than he is. He has no envy. Anything else? Yes. Everybody wants to know this.
But related to that.
Sure, the point is, well, let's do this first, then we'll do the related to that. The point is, where is my source of happiness? That's the point. Sudama had all those things, and he saw it as prasad. That means his happiness was his relationship with Krishna, not the things. And if your happiness is the relationship with Krishna, not the things, and if the things are there, you're happy, and the things are not there, you're happy. Then you're free. If your happiness is dependent on certain things being there, then you can't be happy, because then you're always in anxiety about whether or not the things will be there, which you can't control. If your happiness is dependent on something you can't control, how can you be happy? Isn't that just logical? If my happiness is dependent on something I can't control, how much happiness can I have? I'm always going to feel anxiety. So sure, you can have anything, everything. Why not? Maharaj Yudhisthira had more opulence than Lord Brahma. But that wasn't his happiness. His happiness was his relationship with Krishna. So Maharaj Yudhisthira was just as happy in exile as he was doing the Rajasuya Yajna. Okay, now the cousin. Well, sometimes when people say it doesn't matter, they're just in so much ignorance. You know, like someone who's intoxicated, they're lying on a piece of cardboard on the street. They don't even know where they are. So, and also sometimes people say it doesn't matter out of anger. Well, you get so frustrated, you know, because we're trying to get happiness out of something over which I have no control and very limited influence. And that's a very frustrating situation. By definition, it must be frustrating. So sometimes we just become angry and just say, well, I don't care anymore. You know, it's... Someone, even in the mode of goodness, what to speak of transcendent, they're always feeling joy. Their joy is dependent on something that's within. Their happiness is within. If your happiness is within, then you genuinely don't care about the externals because that's not your source of happiness. What does it matter? It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. You already have everything. It's just like, okay, let's just take money, for example. This is a really simple thing because pretty much everybody wants money. But nobody wants money for money. You want money because it will get you security. That's a big reason people want money. And it will get you freedom. If you have enough money, you don't need to work for anybody. You can get on a plane, you can go where you want, you can buy what you want, right? If you have money, you can get pleasures. You can buy good food and comfortable clothing and the best stereo system. So let's say that you had 100% security, 100% freedom, and 100% pleasure. Would you care about money? No. If you had everything that you want by having money, you wouldn't need the money. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You wouldn't care. So if you have unlimited, ever-expanding pleasure, and in the sense that I'm a soul, nahanyate hanyamane shrire, I feel security. I know I can't be hurt, nobody can hurt me. I never die. If your happiness is dependent on your relationship with Krishna, which can go on in any circumstances, why care about all the things that people get in order to achieve those things, which don't give you them anyway? It just wouldn't matter. Does that make sense? So that's different than then, it just doesn't matter because I'm just so dull, or it doesn't matter because I'm angry. I don't care anymore. You know. Yes?
As you were speaking, if you have your happiness from, say, your relationship with Krishna, you were saying, therefore your happiness is not dependent on the things, well then why would one aspire for, say, your children to be in the best school or to whatever it might be? And because as soon as you do that, if you're quite self-satisfied and you don't really, why would you do it then?
This is such an excellent question. Thank you.
Yeah.
And this question you asked is one of the main reasons why people don't go for self-realization. And I think if we look in the core of our heart, I could say that most likely that this question is there somewhere. Unless we are experiencing unlimited bliss at every moment. It's this fear that, well, if I was fully self-satisfied, I wouldn't do anything anymore. But think of what that's based on. Why is it we want to do all those things? We want to do all those things because we think that they're the source of our happiness. So it's a circular kind of thing. I'm thinking, if I already had happiness, then I wouldn't do those things, and then I wouldn't be happy. But now you're already happy. So now the question is, would a self-realized, self-satisfied person, would they take care of sending their children to good schools? Would they? Mm. Not absolutely necessarily. Some fully self-realized, self-satisfied persons live as avidutas. They live away from society. They have nothing to do with society. They don't work. They don't even interact with people as an ordinary person. They might have had kids. If you're fully self-realized, Krishna says a fully self-realized person has no duties to perform. And the next thing he says, and he has no reason
to not
perform them. So occasionally, very rarely, we will find self-realized souls exhibiting external behavior, which we would term as madness, where they have nothing to do with society, with none of the duties and responsibilities of society. That is sometimes. Generally, the self-realized soul doesn't act that way. Why? Yad yad charity shrestas. Because people will think that's the process. They'll think, oh, if I just become irresponsible and walk around like a madman, then I'll become self-realized. And so it's not generally done. Also, Krishna has things he wants to accomplish, even in this world of illusion. And therefore, one's doing it as a service. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, I now see my home, that this home belongs to you. It's your home, Krishna. That's why we have the altar and the deities, to remind us it's Krishna's home. It's not my house, it's Gornitai's house. They get the food. I spend a good chunk of my money on them. I spend my time on them. Everything's revolving around them. It's their house. Well, if it's their house, then my other family members who live here are their servants. Well, I'm supposed to take care of them. It's my job. And so Krishna's given me that as my job. My happiness is coming from my relationship with Krishna. And Krishna's saying, would you please take care of these people? So we take care of it nicely. Actually, you do your job better. But not for your personal satisfaction. You already have your personal satisfaction. Your relationship with others then becomes on the platform of freedom. So instead of my taking care of you because I'm thinking you're going to give me happiness, which is a calculated business deal ultimately, sorry. But, you know, if I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to really take nice care of my kids because then I'll be happy. If they go to the best schools, I'll be able to say, my kid went to. And they'll do something for me. I'm thinking, I'm doing this as a service. I'm already happy. I don't need anything for my children. I don't need anything for my husband. I don't need anything for my wife. I can just give. You can't imitate that. You cannot imitate it. It's not possible. You'll explode periodically. What about me? You can't do it. But the goal is to come to a point that you're so satisfied, that you're so full, that you can just give. You don't need anything. Therefore, Krishna says there's no need to depend on any other living being. No reason to do anything, no reason not to do anything, no need to depend on any other living being. It's not controlled by the ordinary course of events. It's not controlled by whether things are auspicious or inauspicious. That's freedom. And what's really nice about that is, you know, if somehow your kid doesn't do well in school, you're not devastated. So your life isn't over. You know, if your wife's having a bad day, it goes, hang. It doesn't, your happiness isn't affected. You just think, poor lady. And you can still love. Your love isn't dependent, you know, on whether or not she's nice to you. You can still love. You can still love your boss and your coworkers or whatever. It's not, you're not thinking, well, I can only love them if they're nice to me. But we see that the great souls, they're more responsible in the world because they're doing it as a service. I can't be fully responsible if I'm thinking that my work is the source of my happiness, because as soon as it's not giving me the happiness that I want, then I kind of pull back a little bit. So, well, I don't know if I really want to take this much trouble, you know, it's not really giving me what I want. So, self-realized soul is actually happier and more responsible. Is that okay? Yes?
How do you balance that with, say, women who, they hear that they have to be sheltered from a young
It's only one person you're dependent on. It's only one person who protects you. Six symptoms of surrender. Krishna is my only maintainer. Krishna is my only protector. Krishna is my only shelter. It's not a question of balancing anything. Krishna may be making a certain arrangement for my protection and my maintenance. If you work at a job and your boss gives you a paycheck, I'll tell you, that's coming from Krishna. Whatever care and affection and shelter and guidance your husband gives you, his intelligence is coming from Krishna. And you should serve him and take care of him to please Krishna. If you're just trying to please him, you know, sometimes he'll be pleased and sometimes he won't be pleased. With the same behavior. You know, one day he'll really like your rice, and the next day he won't like the same rice because he had a bad day at work. And if your world revolves around your husband going, oh, this is great, you know, then you're going to go like this. And eventually you're going to be angry. I gave my life to please you and to serve you, and I gave up so many things. And you don't even care about me. Doing it to please Krishna. This is what Krishna's given me. Krishna's telling me to obey my father and my husband, take care of my son, whatever. It's my duty to Krishna, and I'm trying to please Krishna. And my happiness comes from that relationship, and it's Krishna who's maintaining me. And I thank Krishna. I say, thank you, Krishna, for arranging that I have this nice father or this nice husband or this nice son. Or thank you, Krishna, that I don't have such a nice husband and nice father. You see, everything is as prasadam. Even the medicine. Good parents, sometimes they give you one of Kalangana's sweets. And sometimes they give you medicine. Thank your parents for the medicine also. That's also good. Just like if you're sick, we're all sick here. We're all diseased. We don't think we're diseased. Now, just like, please don't think I'm aiming this at anyone in particular. I use this example many times. But just like a person may feel healthy, they may think I'm healthy, you know, and they just go in for their normal physical, and the doctor says, hey, you got cancer, and you believe them. How do you know? You don't know. And they say, here you go. Just look at this test result. And you trust them. And then they say, okay, now we're going to cut you open. And you thank them for that, right? You say, thank you for cutting me open. So you thank Krishna even for the difficult things. Thank him when he gives you nice food to eat and a good husband takes care of you. And the days your husband's mad at you, thank you, Krishna, for reminding me that my happiness is in you. That I'm not going to find what I'm looking for in another jiva. And I'm going to go on with my service. My service is not dependent on this or that external circumstance. Is that okay? Yes.
So, my question is this, right? That Krishna, or God, gives you this pain, right? Which I've read in one of the scriptures I'm reading. The pain is given to you because you're blessed. The reason why it is so is that because when God, Krishna, gives you pain, it is to detach you from this material world. So that you get so, you know, sometimes what happens is the only way you give up material things is that, you know, when you have no control, right? And the reason, you see, that I think there's in the same lectures that I heard, it says that, you know, I think Draupadi asked, you know, when he was very pleased with it, Krishna was very pleased with her. and he asked her, what can I do for you, right? And her actual answer was that, can you put me into hell? You know, that was her wish, to go into hell. And Krishna says, why? Why is that? And the answer she gave, right, was that, so I can never forget you. So when we are in pain, we are more close to God, generally, right? People, you know, so the reason why we get pain in life is so that we, it's kind of a form to give you detachment in this world. Otherwise, we are too materially attached, you know, comfort.
Certainly, you can think of it that way, and I think you're referring to Kunti rather than Draupadi.
Yeah.
But it's explained in the Bhagavatam that the world is engineered to favor the mode of goodness. In other words, the universe is arranged to favor truth. Sattva. Sat means goodness. It also means truth. So anything that's truth is going to bring you more happiness than something that's false. And the way I think of it is if you walk through that door, that will be very pleasant, and if you try to walk through the wall, it will be painful. You can't exactly say that the architect of the house is giving you pain. If you choose to walk through the wall instead of the door, it's not exactly that the architect is giving you pain so you can remember that there's an architect. However, when you walk into the wall, you will feel pain, and then you will probably remember that there's an architect. The person responsible for your pain, though, is you, 100%. So Krishna has no desire to give anybody pain ever. He has no envy. If you have a disease and you go to a doctor and the doctor cuts you open, it's not that the doctor wants to give you pain. But once you become diseased, cutting you open may be the only way to cure you. So our pain is entirely 100% our own doing. As far as Kunti's prayers, that's Kunti's operating on a different platform of existence. So she's not experiencing material miseries as miseries. And what she was talking about was that whenever there was some catastrophe from the external point of view, Krishna personally walked in the door. So she's saying, what I'd like is for you to keep walking in the door. And if the house has to be burning down for you to do that, then let's have the house burn down because I want you to walk in the door. So that's what she was saying. It wasn't that she was saying, I want to suffer. But I mean, quite literally, Krishna was personally. You know, if every time there was some catastrophe, God himself walked into your house, then you'd also say, hey, give me the catastrophe. Because when everything's going fine, you just stay in Dwarka. When there's a problem here, you come to Indraprastha. So let there be problems again and again, so I'll see you again and again. But that's not quite on the level that we're talking about. So it's not that devotees pray for pain. Rather, we should be wanting what Krishna wants for us, which is unlimited joy. You have children?
I do, yeah.
Don't you want them to be happy?
Well, I do want them to be happy, but then again, it's God's desire to really truly believe.
It's not God's desire for us to suffer, no.
No, but I mean, their desire, no, if they're happy or they're sad, it is to do with whatever.
But you would like them to be happy.
Yeah, as a, yes.
Of course. So Krishna also wants you to be happy just like that. You don't want your children to be happy by being drug addicts.
No.
So Krishna doesn't want us to be happy in illusion, where we're not really happy. He wants us to have genuine happiness. And sometimes that may be that he throws us into a drug treatment program. Like you might, you know, if you had a child who was a heroin addict, you might push them into a drug treatment program. But again, you're not making them suffer. They're doing that to themselves. Is that okay? Krishna only wants us to be happy. Krishna doesn't desire anyone to suffer, ever. He never desires for anyone to suffer. Even an ordinary parent doesn't desire for their children to suffer. even a materialistic parent doesn't desire suffering for their children. Even animals don't desire suffering for their children. Not to speak of God. Okay. I think I should stop here because Johnny Taipu was also supposed to speak. So thank you very much.
Thank you.